So recently, Buddha relics were brought from India together with relics of Venerable Sariputta, Vimalananda, for people here in Thailand to pay their respects in Bangkok and Chiang Mai and Ubon and in the south somewhere, I can't remember where. And there's some special emotion, some special feeling that can come into the mind, beautiful feeling when we come into the presence of these relics. Just thinking that this is a physical link to the Lord Buddha and the great disciples. But another kind of relic, and one which we have access to all the time, are the words of the Buddha. These are words that were formed within the Buddha's mind and were entered the world through the Buddha's mouth. So we can take the chants like the Itipiso chant. That's a Buddha relic. It's something that comes directly from the Buddha to us. So many times in the suttas, this passage appears. The stream enterer, for example, is one who has an unshakable faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. So what does that mean, unshakable faith? In what way does one have an unshakable faith? Well, it's unshakable faith that the Buddha is Arahang, Sama, Samputo, Vicha, Charana, Sampanno, and so on. So Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha as refuge are defined in terms of the Sitipiso formula. So what a wonderful way to begin a new day, chanting these words in the Pali language. So if we were transported through time back to Middle India, the Middle Country, 2,500 more years ago, in a Buddhist monastery, we would be able to chant along with the Sangha and with the monks and nuns. So we have a Buddha relic with us whenever we turn to it. The teachings of the Buddha, Sovākhātatam, they're well expounded, systematic, comprehensive. Everything that a human being needs to know in order to free themselves from suffering, defilement, was expounded by the Buddha. He omitted nothing. If there are omissions in the Dhamma, when we look from the viewpoint of modern world, 2,500 more years later, the gaps are in knowledge, which has no direct bearing on the path of practice to enlightenment. So it may be in harmony with it, may not be in harmony with it, but it's not necessary for this practice to bear fruit, because the teaching of the Buddha is well expounded. It's sanditiko, it's realizable. So if we have religious teachings claiming existence of God or gods and telling us how to pray, what ceremonies to perform in order to make our lives safe and to achieve our goals and wishes, we can never know for sure whether that God or gods really exist. It's not something which is verifiable. But sanditiko means verifiable. Teachings of the Buddha we can verify. We can't verify all of the teachings right now, because a lot of the teachings demand that the mind has reached a certain level of maturity and clarity before it can verify those teachings. But they are ultimately verifiable teachings, well expounded, clear, comprehensive, systematic, uplifting teachings, which are verifiable. And they're timeless, because they are teachings revealing the nature of nature, the nature of the human being, the way our minds work. And so the objects of greed for someone alive today, the objects of greed for people in India 2,500 years ago, there'll be certain overlaps. There'll be certain kinds of desire and greed which would not be there in ancient India, but the quality of greed, the causes and conditions for the arising of greed, the causes and conditions for the cessation of greed, these don't change, never will change. And so Dhamma, the teaching which reveals this nature of nature and how to relate to it in the wisest way, this is timeless, sakaliko. And it's ahipasiko, it encourages investigation. The Buddha's making statements. If you grasp onto something as being me and mine a lot, you will suffer a lot. If you grasp onto things as being me and mine a little bit less, you'll suffer a little bit less. If you don't grasp onto anything as being me and mine, you won't suffer at all. These are the kinds of statements that we come across in the Dhamma teachings of the Buddha and of his great disciples. So these are challenging teachings. Ahipasika means it challenges you. It's not a matter of reading something, accepting it, and then putting it down, saying, yeah, no, I'm a Buddhist, I believe that. But these are statements about your life and how to live your life. So these are, let's say, existentially challenging statements that you can't just read and then put down. The word Upanayako is a little bit more obscure, and it's translated in different ways. You can never be sure with dead language. So sometimes it's translated as leading onwards, sometimes as leading inwards. But in both, we don't have to choose. We can take both. It leads us onwards and leads inwards to look within. But in either case, it doesn't leave you where you started. It takes you on a journey. And you change through studying the nature of change. You change. Through studying Dhamma, it's not like studying a language or studying an academic discipline. There's no reason at all why you should change as a human being because you accumulated knowledge of a particular academic discipline. But you can't study, practice the Dhamma sincerely, consistently, without changing. That's the whole point. Leads you onwards, doesn't lead you around in circles, leads you upwards and onwards. But that upward and onward journey requires you to delve within, so it leads you inwards as well. But this work of Dhamma is it's work that has to be undertaken and can only be successful through your own efforts. But at the same time, the ability to put forth that effort is dependent on good friends, Kalyana Mitta. So we say we're all alone together. We draw upon the goodness and kindness and wisdom, compassion of our teachers and Kalyana Mittas in order to do this work that no one else can do for us. And this responsibility lies with us. We can't just ride on the barami of great beings or expect them to bless us and to purify our defilements. We have to do that ourselves. So Buddha Dhamma is teaching is self-reliance, but learning the skill of self-reliance in society, in the society of good friends. So it comes to right now. Taking responsibility for our life and for our present and thus our future and our past, they're all included in the present. Doing this work of caring for the mind, creating a quality, a stability, clarity of awareness which will prevent the arising of as yet unarisen and wholesome dhammas. And that if we lose our mindfulness, as will inevitably happen, we don't lose it for long. We re-establish awareness more and more fluently. We develop skillful means to deal with the various hindrances, defilements that can arise and envelop the mind so easily. We bring into the mind its wholesome qualities, mindfulness, clear comprehension, artapi, right effort. We start to experience the rising of the jhana factors, the arising of the bojangas, the constituent elements of the mind that is ready for liberation. So we take as these wholesome, beautiful qualities arise in the mind, we learn how to cultivate them, to develop them further, bring them to maturity. So we have an object, and the technique and the object is something to be appreciative of, grateful to, but not to become obsessed by. So it's the technique is like the finger pointing to the moon. Enables us to see the moon. We don't want to become too, technique obsessed. The technique is a tool to establish, stabilize awareness in the present moment. The present moment is the classroom. It's not the goal in itself to be in the present moment, but to penetrate the profound meaning of the Four Noble Truths, you have to be in the classroom of the Four Noble, of the present moment. So examine and just evaluate the quality of your relationship with your meditation object. I spoke last night about staring at it. Don't hold on to it too tightly. Don't stare at your object. You want to be together with the object. And in the case of the breath, you need to find a way of appreciating the breath, enjoying the breath, so that you prefer present moment awareness, you prefer mindfulness, reliant on the breath to imagination, fantasy, memory. So when there is that intimate, warm relationship with the breath, then the likelihood of the hindrances arising is vastly reduced. Just one breath at a time. That's so one meditation, one breath. Every breath matters. At the beginning, if you're finding difficulty sustaining awareness for the whole duration of an in-breath and out-breath, you can divide the breath into three phases: the beginning phase, the middle phase, and the concluding, the final phase of the in-breath and the out-breath. So rather than your intention being to be mindful of the whole body of the in-breath, the whole body of the out-breath, the whole duration, then now your intention is to be aware of the whole initial phase of the in-breath, the whole middle phase of the in-breath, the whole final phase of the in-breath, the whole initial phase of the out-breath, the whole of the middle phase, and the whole of the final phase. So be a little bit more precise and preventing the mind wandering off. Often at the end of the out-breath is a likely time for the mind to lose mindfulness. And of course there are these other two shorter phenomena, the change, the end of the in-breath and the beginning of the out-breath, the end of the out-breath, beginning of the in-breath. So be aware of those two also. So now you have eight things to be aware of: beginning, middle, and end of in-breath and out-breath, and the change, the transition from in-breath to out-breath and out-breath to in-breath. This is another skillful means that may be of use sometimes in the practice. So being a little bit creative, seeing what your weakness is. If you do tend to lose mindfulness, does it tend to be on the in-breath or the out-breath, the beginning or in the middle or the end? Then you can apply suitable remedies.